From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And we do that by building the backyard advantage. We're building the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. And it's based around this culture of love, helping one another. So it's one entrepreneur at a time, one conversation at a time. And that conversation, it can begin with, what are you working on and how can I help? And so that's really what we're trying to do, is just help people. And sometimes we do that on the show through educational stuff. And so today we have Brad Frisk. He is the CEO of Cypress Creek Capital Group. He's also a financial consultant with Raymond James. And we're going to be talking about something that I get a lot of questions on is, Mark, I'm thinking about selling my business. Thoughts. What do I do? Where do I start? How do I begin thinking about this concept? So we're going to break that down a little bit, like how to sell your company, because a lot of people are, even if you're not in the position right now where your company has a lot of value, it hopefully will someday, and we'll be able to kind of get you ready and get you thinking along those lines. So with no, oh, and I want to remind you, I'm going to talk about an event that is coming up for kind of on this concept, and we'll talk about that a little bit later too, because it's coming up on the 16th of this month. So if you're interested in thinking about how to sell your company, this might be an event you want to think about. So with that said, ladies and gentlemen, meet Brad Frisk. How are you doing, Brad?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Now, maybe just if we could start with just a little bit of your background. Mm-hmm. And you know how you got to in the business you're in, and then we'll get into some of the, you know, do's and don'ts of you know, what you're doing when you're trying to sell your company.
Yeah, no, thanks, I appreciate it, and I love what you're doing here. So thanks so much for really leading the charge on entrepreneurship in Sacramento. I think it's great.
Thank you.
I've been in financial services for almost 20 years. Almost all of that time has been working with business owners.
Okay.
I spent a good amount of time working with JP Morgan in San Francisco as a commercial banker, and kind of led the state in production there. I had a client of mine who's actually a really good friend now pull me aside and basically say, listen, dude, you're really good at what you do. I think you're in the wrong line of business. Let me make some introductions for you. And so he introduced me to a team at Morgan Stanley on Sand Hill Road, which is where really the birthplace of everything that I'm doing right now, you know, took place. While I was there, I got to witness incredible investment banking resources matched with very high-end private wealth management. And it just struck a chord with me. So really enjoyed my time there. My wife is from Rockland, so we ended up relocating to Rockland.
Perfect. Right.
I was doing this, I tell people, I was doing this death triangle of a commute. We lived in Walnut Creek.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go to Sand Hill Road.
Yeah, that's a pretty good jaunt too, just
yeah.
That.
Oh, it was rough. And then to San Francisco for meetings. Oh, and I would just basically die a slow death on the 24 coming back home. So there was a point where, you know, I got the discussion of, hey, let's figure out what the plan is. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, we came back to Sacramento.
How long have you been here?
We've been here about 11 years.
Okay, you've been here a while.
Yeah. Yeah, moved to Rockland, and then just a couple of years ago, moved to Lincoln. Yeah, so, yeah.
And you're married, you have kids?
Married, three kids.
Okay.
14-year-old son, 10-year-old son, and a 7-year-old little girl.
Okay, do they want to grow up to be investment bankers, or what are they thinking?
Honestly, man, my oldest son is, both my boys are serious entrepreneurs.
Interesting.
Yeah, they've both created pressure washing businesses, and so they go door to door and ask to pressure wash garbages.
Wow.
Which they have down
that to. That is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty impressive. You know what? But when I think back to my history as a kid, I was a guy doing like a Kool-Aid stand mm-hmm. on the corner, or, you know, selling mistletoe. I was always looking for a way to make some money.
Interesting.
And I think they're probably following in my footsteps there a little bit.
You got to be proud of that. That's great. It's one of those occupations that is not going to go away. Being an entrepreneur, I mean, we keep hearing about AI and how that's going to affect the workforce and what jobs might be eliminated or streamlined. Being an entrepreneur, though, that's probably not going away. There's probably always a place for the people with the imagination and with a little bit of risk taking and the ability to persevere and do some hard work.
Yeah, I mean, my personal opinion is that it's part of the American spirit. I think that, you know, as long as we're around, we're going to have people who are looking at situations thinking, this can be done better, or there's an error in this process and I can fix it. So I agree with you.
And in what you're doing, you're working with entrepreneurs, it sounds like, that are highly successful. You are helping companies that are, let's call it mid-sized companies. Maybe describe the kind of companies that are sort of your typical client.
Yeah, so we work with business owners in the lower middle market and middle market. And so what do I mean by that? Lower middle market, you could define as companies that are valued at maybe $5 million up to $50
million. Okay.
Middle market's a step up from there, so $50 million to $500 million or more. These are, you know, companies that are typically too successful for a local business broker, mm-hmm. but not quite big enough to be on Wall Street's radar. And so they're really the backbone of the U.S. economy. They're, you know, family run, founder led, multi-generational private companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that, the role of an investment banker for a second. So you use the term business broker and investment banker. I'm kind of curious as to how you see the difference and when is that sort of cutoff line when you, and then for those, maybe describe what an investment banker is too, real quick, and then we can kind of divide the investment banking type of work from maybe a business broker type work.
Yeah, so investment bankers are, you know, I think a lot of times people think that they're just there to just sell your company. In my opinion, they're your biggest advocate. I mean, you are, think of it like an agent to an athlete or a celebrity, mm-hmm. right? They're the buffer between you as the business owner and these buyers. And the reality is that, you know, buyers are out there and they're doing this every day. And business owners are probably going to go through this once. And so the investment banker's role is really to level that playing field, bring in those resources, and ultimately do the best job possible of just telling the business owner's story. So,
and is okay. So, where did the term investment banker come from? Because it sounds, I mean, you're basically helping broker a deal too, but you're not called, an agent. It's investment banker. Yeah. It's got a lot of bank and investment. Doesn't sound quite as much like the other roles.
Yeah, I mean the origin of that title, I honestly don't know, but. You know, investment banking is matching a buyer and a seller through mm-hmm. typically, you know, a very specific process that includes big investors, which, you know, might be banks, financial institutions with, you know, business owners of various levels.
And the biggest investment bankers are people like Morgan Stanley, people you've heard the names before, yeah. JP Morgan,
Goldman.
So there's these big ones and you are, would you consider your company more of a like a boutique type opportunity or operation?
Yeah, so yeah, that's a great question. So our investment banking services are really broken into two segments. With Raymond James Investment Bank, we have a minimum transaction size of $100 million. Okay? So $100 million up, it's probably three quarters sell side, maybe 25-ish% buy side. But we are helping business owners kind of get through that process to go to market. Where I spend most of my time is with founders that are in maybe the, you know, 20 million up to, I'd probably say $120 million valuation size. Mm-hmm. And for those relationships, we have a network of boutique firms throughout the US that we have an agreement with. And so what typically happens is after learning more about the business and the business owner and their goals, well, we will match them with a boutique firm, kind of set up a little bit of a date or an interview process, which allows them to kind of get acquainted and see if it's a good fit. But the bankers that we bring in will typically be, you know, very active and knowledgeable in the space, the industry of the business owner that we're speaking with. And so I've even seen occasions where other teams throughout the U.S. have used a boutique firm instead of Raymond James Investment Bank because there was a better fit there.
So you use the term business broker at the beginning. Typically, when you think of a business broker, I think of a somebody who's going to sell a company that might be doing a couple million in sales or something like that. At what point do they sort of graduate to maybe choosing an investment banker? And how do you make the decision to like make that leap and choose one over the other?
Yeah, that's a good question. The answer isn't so cut and dry, but typically a boutique firm is probably wanting to get involved at about a 5 million EBITDA.
Okay. 5 million in earnings, profits for people that aren't familiar with EBITDA. Yep. Okay.
You know, anything less than that, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't be having a conversation with an investment banker, because you could have things in the pipeline that are going to get you there real quick, or some expansion or an acquisition. But typically, you know, once you get around that 5 million EBITDA figure, you start talking to boutique firms that are highly specialized in your industry.
Okay. Okay. So I'm going to dive into that in a little bit, but that sets it up, I think. So we're talking to an entrepreneur and he or she is asking, why should I sell? Should I not sell? And so I'm kind of wondering, what are the typical reasons people think that they probably ought to be thinking about selling?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different reasons that people consider selling. Some good ones, I would say, maybe some that aren't really on your side. I'd say what we want to prevent are business owners that are getting burnt out. You know, maybe sales are flattening, and so they're thinking, hey, let's get out of this. That makes it very challenging in the investment banking engagement and the competitive process to really make a case for why you want to acquire that business. But at the same time, you see business owners who are maybe want to pass the business on to the next family member, mm-hmm. right? So some intrafamily transfer. You know, maybe they're just wanting to retire. Maybe they were approached, which I think is very common. You know, an unsolicited offer from a competitor happens quite a bit. But it honestly could be a number of different reasons. And we really never know. I mean, I always joke with people that, you know, a business owner is not for sale, right? You talk to an entrepreneur or a founder, I'm good, I'm not for sale, we're doing great, until they are, right? Until they get that offer and the number is, you know, so high and above what they thought, you know, they're ready to go right then and there. So
okay, so I know of people, buddies that have sold their business and they've got an unsolicited offer that is that they want to take.
Yeah.
And what I have seen is them, I've encouraged them to get an investment banker anyway, and they come away with a better deal at the end of running a full process, because if they've got a hot property, there's probably more than one potential buyer, and that investment banking, the process that we go through, ends up getting us better terms or better pricing or something, and they're happy that they use an investment banker, even though there's a fee associated with using an investment banker.
Right. Yeah, and I think that just scratches the surface, to be honest with you. You know, it's not only running through, you know, preparation, you know, the process, but also the plan after the sale. I think it's the most overlooked aspect. When I talk to business owners who have been through sales, you know, it's a very emotional experience for them. So they've been successful enough to really build a phenomenal company, and they go from, you know, that being their, you know, their reputation and their identity, and then they kind of give up a part of themselves through the sale, right? And so afterwards, you know, there's a little bit of a loss feeling and a little bit of unsure where to go. So I think that there are really three main parts. Preparation, which in my mind, preparation is where millions, if not tens of millions of dollars can be created. And that's not only on the business exit side, but also on the personal financial planning side. The process, which can be, you know, very cumbersome, going through due diligence and IOIs and LOIs and reps and warranties and all those different aspects of it. But then also transitioning to life after the sale, which looks different for a lot of people. Maybe it's, you know, tapping into philanthropic goals or taking board seats or, I mean, even having a clear vision on, you know, what your plan is with your family after, I think is a good idea. And it's often overlooked.
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, so let's, I'm going to dive back in. Let's go through these three components of the process. But Why, you said if you're just burned out and you know you're kind of wanting to retire, that's not a good reason. I think that's why a lot of people want to do it. Yeah. So what happens when that's where you're at? What how do you get your arms around that kind of way of thinking or feeling?
Yeah, I would say engage a team. Okay. Right? Maybe an investment banker, maybe just a wealth advisor who has some contacts, mm-hmm. like tax attorneys or business attorneys. But a lot of this, whether you're ready to sell or not, is just about realistic expectations. So if you know that your business is flattening out, or you know that you have customer concentration, or you've lost a key employee, or you're just done, right? Or you're just burnt out and ready to go, you can't expect to go through the same process as somebody who has spent the last 3 years preparing, right? Going through evaluation, cleaning up their financials, checking in with their management team, offloading responsibilities from the founder to management. You know, buyers want to buy a company that is not only looking transferable, but also scalable without the founder in the driver's seat. And so if you're just ready to get out, like, you know, that might not be your story. And so
I guess my advice to you, if you're listening, is if you are just ready to get out, don't quite announce that yet. Put your company in a position to be acquired, have it growing, hopefully, have it increasing in profits and revenue, have a management team set up so mm-hmm. that the transition's smooth. And even though you might be ready to retire, you don't need to necessarily telegraph that if you are a big asset in the company. You want to be honest, of course, but don't appear to be out of gas or have the right management and team that is hyper motivated, you know, very, very motivated, so that it's going to run without you.
Yeah. I'd say I agree with what you just said, but I would put the emphasis on the honesty part. I would be, you know, as honest as you possibly can with your investment banker. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are going to go tell your story better than probably anybody else outside of you can do it. I mean, that's not the only reason. That's one of the major reasons you're paying them, is to, mm-hmm. you know, represent you. And so there are, you know, there a great banker can, you know, hear that from you, understand where you are, have some empathy and kind of start to educate you on the market, right? Well, hey, given your business and what's going on right now, like you're maybe looking at this multiple range. You know, maybe these are the type of buyers, or maybe it looks like, hey, listen, this is actually this is something that we can correct, and so let's look at making some adjustments here, and we might actually get you onto a path where the numbers look really attractive.
Right, he'll package the business, and yeah. And that might take a couple of years too, right? That
Absolutely.
Could take a lot of time to get yourself in a different role potentially within the company, or get the right infrastructure set up in order to, you know, have it packaged for maximum value.
Yeah. I'd say, you know, minimum 12 months. You know, where we see the best outcomes is where a business owner has taken 2 or 3 years at least to kind of, you know, dress the business up and really address and kind of get through any aspects of the company that might bring the value down. And like I said before, this is all in the preparation stage. And this is where millions, if not tens of millions of dollars in value can be created in just making some tweaks. I mean, if you have, you know, 60% of your revenues coming from one customer, that's a serious concentration issue. And so you either need to readjust your expectations or start figuring out what you can do about that and talking mm-hmm. to your banker for some solutions.
Okay, so let's talk about the preparation. Maybe top three things. Obviously, concentration of customers is going to be a big deal, but what are the things that we've got to do? Audited financials. Mm-hmm. How many years? What should that look like in terms of you know, the prep on the financial side?
Yeah, that's a great question for accountants and attorneys. So one thing that's important to know about my company is we're really like, I'd call it like an air traffic controller, right? So our business owners are the passengers, and they're trying to get their destination in a smooth way. and you have all these planes there. One might be your accountant, one might be your CPA, one might be your tax attorney, estate planning attorney, M&A advisor, investment banker. And so my role is really to coordinate that team and make sure that things are going smoothly, but more importantly, that planes are landing in the correct order, right? So I would imagine that audited financials, you're probably looking at least the last 3 years of financials for, mm-hmm. for review. But you're also, you know, you're going to get into a quality of earnings process, which is, I mean, it more or less like a financial colonoscopy, right? It's very uncomfortable. It can last a long time.
Do you recommend getting a quality of earnings prior to going on the market?
I think it's nice to do that just so you have a sense of what's going on with the business.
Yeah. So I can go through just stories that I've heard or been around in a quality of earnings. So you say your company is making $10 million in EBITDA, and then it runs through, let's call it the buyer's quality of earnings people, and they beat that number up a little bit. Maybe they call out some concentration of mm-hmm. customers, maybe some other things around your contracts and the repeatability of some of these contracts that you have that's leading to your sales and EBITDA. And they knock it down from, you know, 10 to 9. And that, you know, that knocks down the sale price quite a bit. And so if you go in ahead of time and get a quality of earnings done that matches the audited financials, and you can back it up with your own accountants, you're going in with something that's a little bit more packaged. Of course, they can still beat it up, but at least you're kind of being preemptive on the packaging.
No, absolutely. It gives you clarity as the business owner on what the other side is going to look at within your company. I mean, if you have lumpy cash flows, or maybe you need to address, you know, owner's expenses that are being run through the company, or even owner's compensation. Those things can all be hashed out early through a Q of E process in preparation for going to market.
Yeah, and a Q of E for a, let's call it a $50 million company in sales, that's going to cost, what, 30 to 50 grand? 30 grand?
Probably somewhere in that range, yeah. Again, that's a question for the accountants yeah. that go through that.
But. And audited financial statements are going to cost 50 grand a year,
yeah,
ish,
yeah.
You know, ballparking. Mm-hmm. So you've got some expenses associated with doing the deal, and oftentimes those expenses, they won't go directly against your EBITDA,
right?
You can sort of have those as one-off type of expenses.
Yeah, no, they are. You know, one-time expenses, also something that you can just have a conversation about, but they're important, right? It's mm-hmm. important to get those things in place and, you know, have a conversation about them and kind of be armed as you go through the process.
Okay, so what about systems? Like in every business has got HR, human resources type systems. Maybe you've got IT systems and other systems associated with your factory. How important is it to have those systems obviously running smoothly, but documentation and clarity around what it is so that the buyer can understand that they're buying a solid system?
I mean, it's critical, right? I mean, think about purchasing a home, right? You don't just go make a cash offer on a home without doing your research, without understanding, you know, who was formerly in the home, what the neighborhood looks like, what does the foundation look like, when was it built, and so on and so forth. Selling a business is very similar, right? You want to have your deliverable story of your business clear cut so that the buyer, whether it's a financial buyer like private equity or a family office, or a strategic buyer, which are industry players like, you know, maybe a competitor or a distributor or a supplier, you want them to be able to see the financials and have their team look through the financials and really see a clear story on what's going on with your business. And I don't think that it's ever going to be perfect, but if there's clarity around this is a sore spot within the business, it's easier to get past that. It's easier than if it was found after the fact and it looks like you're trying to kind of skirt it under the rug, I would say.
Okay, so what about creating a data room and all the confidentiality agreements associated with people coming in and looking at your stuff? Maybe what kinds of things go into the data room besides your financials that would be very private? You wouldn't want a competitor to see necessarily. You wouldn't want anybody to see probably. Mm-hmm. How do you sort of navigate that process?
Yeah, well, that's part of the due diligence process, right? Where you're basically getting all of your intellectual property, all of your confidential information, and you're sharing it with somebody who's potentially wanting to buy your company. A lot of times you're going to set up a SIM, right? So a confidential information memorandum. And then you might do an anonymous one pager, right? And just kind of getting some interest. So it's a step-by-step process to get through that. Really identify buyers that are serious and are looking for a company that looks like yours. And then, you know, in a very sensitive way, moving that conversation forward and kind of progressing it. But
interesting. Yeah, interesting to think about as far as, so we'll keep walking this through this process. Sorry to interrupt you, mm-hmm. but the SIM, just to identify these terms for people. I remember in companies I've sold, and they typically call it the SIM, or I've had some people call it the book, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really could be like 40 or 50 pages about all the great things about your company. You know, so maybe walk through what that looks like for people.
Yeah, I mean, it's your opportunity to share, you know, the details about your company under an NDA where it's very protected, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, think about having a competitor look to buy your business, and you're getting ready to share all of your secrets with them, and so that can be a very uncomfortable thought for business owners who maybe have some very significant intellectual property or kind of trade secrets within their company. So this is part of the process that really protects that seller to kind of tire kick, if you will, mm-hmm. and see, hey, is this something that I'm ready for, and is this something that is marketable through a competitive process with an investment banker?
So at what point in time in the process, so maybe I'll kind of try to walk us through this process. So you hire the investment banker, you're ready to go, you've started the dating room, you built out a team, right? You mentioned building, getting right accountants and attorneys on board, mm-hmm. and so you got the team, and then you make a list of buyers, of potential buyers, and attack that. How does yeah. that work? And when do they get to see this stuff? How serious do they have to show that they are before you got to pull up the dress?
Yeah. Every situation is different. But what we typically see is that first step is in engaging an investment banking team. They're going to run through some just research on your company to get an understanding of it. Once they start to share it with other potential buyers, that's when things really start to pick up, right? Once they get the IOIs or the indication of interest out there, that's when you know things are getting really serious,
right? And at that point, they're getting to get the IOIs. Is that a one pager? You're basically putting out a small amount of information to get yeah. some indications of interest.
Typically, yeah.
Okay,
yeah, that happens around like the same timing as a SIM, right? You've got some protection in place. You put yes. a teaser out there, you share a little bit, you get some IOIs, then you move to some LOIs, and then you kind of narrow it down to whichever buyer you think is worth moving forward with.
And maybe I'll back up a little bit, because I think you mentioned this earlier, and I've often thought about how to decide on what investment banker. Obviously, you want somebody you can get along with who's competent, but there are investment bankers that have a certain area of expertise or industry focus. I know that we've sold companies in the security camera space, and there's boutique firms that specialize in that realm. How do you choose? How do you go about finding out who those people are? Because they know the players in yeah. that space maybe better than somebody who's more like a generalist, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that they're probably already calling you, right? They're probably already reaching out to you asking if you're interested in selling your company.
The investment bankers from that space.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I know, you know, right now, particularly private equity is sitting on like record levels of dry powder. So I don't know if we've come across too many business owners that, you know, are asking us for their help who haven't been taking calls on a regular basis for years, right? Mm-hmm. They're reaching out. They're on the phones. They're trying to get in front of you. So I would say, you know, understanding that demand is important. But you know, shameless plug, that's where my company really comes in and helps out, because we have a menu of boutique firms that we work with. We have Raymond James, right? Over 700 bankers in four countries. And so it's really my role to look at the business, understand the industry and the goals, and then go find one or two boutique firms and set up an interview for
fit. Okay, so let's say I have a manufacturing company, and we manufacture, I don't know, it could be anything. Well, maybe I'll go industry specific. We manufacture security cameras, and because that's the business I was in. Where would you go to, you would find somebody and like match them up with somebody other than yourself?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not, you aren't the one taking this show on the road.
No. Okay. As I mentioned before, I am air traffic control. Okay. I'm managing the process. And really, it's not just investment banking. It is a concurrent process with wealth management, estate planning, and tax planning.
Okay.
I think the error that I found years ago is that you have investment bankers and they're phenomenal at what they do, right? They know their industry like nobody knows their industry, but they're really not too focused on what's happening on the personal side, right? Mm-hmm. And there are certain things that you do on this side, like LOI, that negate lots of tax opportunities on this side. And so my team focuses on coming in and almost assuming a role of like COO, right? Where mm-hmm. we're looking at everything going on the personal side. We're looking at everything happening on the business side. We're going to assess the situation. Shockingly, you know, very, very frequently we're finding that there is no synergy in those teams at all. They're not talking. Your tax attorney is not talking to your CPA, who's not talking to your bookkeeper, who's not talking to your business attorney, who's not talking to your estate planning attorney. And nobody's talking to the investment bankers because they're so busy and they don't really care. Right. They're just trying to go to market and get right. the best deal for you as possible. And so we come in, identify the business needs and goals, you know, get them matched up with the best bankers possible who can really do a phenomenal job at telling their story, monitor that process and communicate to the other side, hey, listen, this is moving faster than we thought. Let's make sure that we're looking at things like, you know, charitable donations or installment sale trusts or some really cool tax tools that are available to you prior to an LOI. And that gives you the opportunity to not only, you know, accelerate your value on the business side by going through a defined process and a competitive one, but on the personal side, really start to tweak the net after-tax number with your proceeds from sale.
Right.
And so, no, I am not a banker. I don't specialize in any one industry. I work with a team of bankers. And, you know, coincidentally, you bring it up. There's a company that we're working with right now, and I can't share too much information. I can't really share any information about it. But very similar to your company and what you describe, they came to me a few months ago through a referral of a valuation expert here in town in Sacramento. And their concern was, look, you know, we've been building this to sell, but we don't have a team in place. And this is very common, right? Business owners have their heads in the sand, and it's, hey, can we get this thing to work? Mm-hmm. Hey, this is actually starting to get some traction. And then it's, oh my gosh, let's pick our head up out of the sand. We need help in so many different areas. And so that was the story with this company. And they came to me, we assessed their accountant, their attorney. They were really not specialized in transactions. So we've brought in some great local firms. We've built a team around them. We've built expectations for process, and we're going through that now. But yeah, it's a lot to juggle for a business owner.
Okay, so what's the fee structure typically for an investment banker? And then where do you guys take a piece of the sale amount, or are you just kind of a flat fee or something like that?
Yeah, so you'll find variations of that. Excuse me. We are typically working on a retainer.
Okay.
Pardon me. Working on a retainer and taking some sort of a success fee.
Okay.
And so that's going to vary between Raymond James Investment Bank and that team or the boutique firm. And oftentimes it's influenced by amount of work that might need to go mm-hmm. into it. You know, if you're looking at you know, rolling some equity and doing a second bite at the apple, you know, maybe that might factor into it as well. An earnout might factor into it. So all those things weigh in on that fee in that process.
Okay. So maybe just give us some ballpark for the investment banker. Typically it's what percentage based upon what kind of success? What are you going to see? What's the range?
Yeah. Boutique firms, you might see something around 3%, give or take. When you get into the traditional investment banking, probably closer to 1 to 2.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit lower.
And then if they hit some super high number that's maybe more than expected, then maybe there's a kicker of some kind that.
Yeah, absolutely. So you might see like a boutique firm that's somewhere around 3, bump it up to 5 or 6 if they go over a certain level.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. And then maybe just talk a little bit about valuations, because that people always think their company is worth more than what it is. It's it's amazing how that works. But some companies are valued based upon EBITDA, excuse me, which I would say is the majority of the, I'd call it Main Street type businesses are usually valued on EBITDA, but some that are fast growing tech companies are sometimes valued based upon a multiple of sales. So maybe talk us through some of that stuff.
Yeah, most of our work is based off of EBITDA, mm-hmm. right? So valuations are based off of EBITDA and a multiple, which is going to be, you know, industry specific. It's going to be influenced by interest rates. It's going to be influenced by, you know, I think access to credit mm-hmm. and cash. So there's a lot of things that can kind of manipulate that number. But
You're saying the market right now is. I don't know if you use the word frothy. There's a lot of money on the sidelines mm-hmm. waiting to be deployed, and interest rates have crept up a little bit. So that means if it's, say, someone like private equity who's going to need to go borrow the money in order to make the acquisition, they have to factor in the cost of capital. Is that where you're going with the interest rates?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you think about just access to capital and the cost for it, right? So if there's a higher interest rate you're dealing with, you're going to have a higher cost to get access to that capital, which is going to influence how you're going to structure your deal.
So typically they're doing leveraged buyouts, right? Is that what you're seeing a lot? Private equity to start with here is, you know, they've got money that they've raised from their investors and they go to make an acquisition, but they don't want to use all their money. They would like to use, I don't know, 50% of their money and then maybe go get the rest financed. Is that typically what you see?
Yeah, we see a lot of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And would I rather sell to a strategic or would I rather sell to a private equity or a family office?
It really depends. I mean, I know I've said that a few times. You know, financial buyers like private equity and family offices, they're probably going to want you to stick around, right? They're going to want you to potentially stay in the business for a few years. So maybe you're looking at rolling some equity there and retaining mm-hmm. a stake in the company and
kind of having a 10 or 20% stake in the company.
And, sure. Yeah. And really just having a vested interest in seeing it succeed, where, you know, a strategic buyer, like a competitor or a distributor or supplier, they may just want you to get out of the way, right? They may want to acquire you to expand into a new market or to, you know, get some competitive pricing on something. And so every deal is different, and I'm not saying they always go that way, but more often than not, like your financial buyers are probably going to want you to stick around, whereas your strategic buyer might be more willing to say, hey, here's your one-time check. Thanks. Mm-hmm. We'll take it from here.
Yeah. And typically what I've seen anyway is if you're part of a roll-up, in other words, there's a private equity company buying a number of companies in that space to sort of put them all together, they're looking to drive a lot of cost out of the business. Probably, right? And they're really putting these companies together so they can build a larger company that's got more value. And I'd say they're more price sensitive too. They want to drive, you know, they've just got certain metrics that they're going to pay, where a strategic might see like real value on how they could create a lot of synergies for themselves by adopting your product line potentially.
Yeah, there might be more qualitative value in a strategic purchase where, I mean, private equity might just be buying you to bolt you onto something, creating an opportunity for arbitrage and selling it, right?
I mean, buy a $50 million company, buy 10 $50 million companies, and now you've got a $500 million company, which is automatically going to get you a bigger multiple.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So we see it a lot of different ways, but
yeah. Okay. So EBITDA, certain types of companies, their EBITDA excuse me, let's see how to put this. They're going to sell at a lower EBITDA rate. Somebody's going to be, one company's going to be 12 times EBITDA. Another one might be like 5 times EBITDA.
Yeah, I love this. So yeah, this topic is great. What I say to people is just because your buddy got an 8 multiple doesn't mean that you will, right? Mm-hmm. You could be two companies in the same, even in the same industry, competitors, but one has gone through, you know, a process of preparation. They have a management team in place. They can walk away from the business and it's going to run as if they were never there. They've gotten all of their HR stuff in place. There's a wonderful culture. There's community involvement. And so all of those factors really weigh into, again, the story that this investment banker can build on for you. Whereas, you know, the other guy, he might just be doing similar numbers, but he might not be prepared. He might have lumpy cash flow. He might have concentration. He might have, you know, a ton of personal expenses running through the business. And so even as you get through that, you know, that spaghetti mess of information and prepare, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work for those companies to kind of go through to get a clearer vision of where they're at.
And when I've dealt with this in the past, it reminds me of my daughter who is a realtor. She sells houses and like high-end homes, and there's comps, right? There's comparisons mm-hmm. from, you know, this, you know, these homes in this neighborhood are selling for $400 a square foot. You know, this is kind of similar to some of those. You can see that within certain industries too, where you can actually do comps within the industry. Other companies this size have kind of sold for that amount of money.
You can. You can, but you know, just because a house has a similar square footage and bedrooms and bathrooms doesn't mean when you walk in it, it doesn't have termite damage or the whole place needs to be updated. And so there's more to the story than just what's on the surface level. And I think that's a very common, you know, mistake that business owners and founders make is they think, hey, my company does what that company does. They got this multiple and this payout. I'm going to get that same thing. And that's not always the case. It could be the case. You could do better, but you really need to go through that process to, you know, look under the hood and really assess the full situation with a professional team who can share with you how to kind of fine tune that instrument and get it ready for a sale.
Okay. So let's talk about the due diligence process or maybe the whole process, but one of the more stressful times is, so you get the LOI and everybody agrees on the purchase price and the terms. And then, so you kind of start down this process and you're still sort of negotiating out the deal, the terms, the final terms of the transfer agreement and so on. Those can be really, really stressful because if you don't agree, the deal falls apart. If your business doesn't keep operating like it has been, the deal can fall apart. So there are multiple things that that happen that are highly stressful for the person that is, you know, deep into the company and trying to juggle 1,000 things. Now they've got the biggest sale of their life on their hands. Mm-hmm. And maybe just those emotions, maybe any sense as to how to navigate those stressful moments.
Yeah. Be prepared for them.
Yeah.
They're going to happen. There's no way you're going to go through a process to step away from something that you have poured your heart and soul into and you have so much pride for, and you're just not going to go through that process without having some really uncomfortable moments, right? Because the buyer is looking at it from a different point of view. They're looking to poke holes. Like, they're looking for ways that they can negotiate. And so I would say be prepared for it. I'd say that the other topic there to make sure that we touch on is, again, getting to those two concurrent paths. That's an investment banking and a go-to-market process. But there's a whole other side of the story with your personal life, right? Understanding what's happening after the sale, understanding what that looks like. What are your passions there? Maybe it's a new venture. Maybe it's like, at times we'll present new clients who sold their company with like a private equity investment that is concentrated in middle market companies that are based off of revenue. We just did this with an NFL quarterback who's retired. And so that allows them to still kind of have their toe in the water of, mm-hmm. hey, this is still, you know, a company I can follow. This is still kind of fun for me. But yeah, the idea of getting through the process without getting some bumps and bruises and maybe a stitch or two, you know, you're probably in for a surprise.
Yeah, I have definitely advised my friends of that. Just get ready. Make sure your health is good. Make sure you got everything lined up in your life. Make sure your spouse is on board for being supportive. Your kids, they know you're going to be going. It's like a little bit like starting a business. You know, it's going to be, I'm going to have to put a lot into this during this time, and it might take a while. And so just sort of bear with me. You sort of have to sell on the back end in order to carve out yourself some leeway a little bit for being stressed.
I think this is probably the most overlooked and maybe the most important part of this process is creating a plan on the personal side for what life looks like after the sale. I can't stress this enough that there is a clear pattern of business owners that sell their company and feel a loss of purpose and a loss of identity. And so
that can create depression on people. I've seen it right and left. They just got the biggest payday of their life and they're depressed a year later.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely it can. So I think understanding, you know, what your goals are after the sale and working with a team that can maybe reverse engineer that, right? So, hey, based on what you're telling me, this is what your lifestyle is going to look like. And so really, this is the number that you actually need out of the sale to be able to accomplish all that. And this is just through a planning process that we do with the certified financial planner. And so you reverse engineer it to, okay, well, you're probably going to pay this much in taxes and you're probably going to go spend this right away on these toys or this home or pay off a mortgage. And so this is the number that you actually need to gross out of the sale in order to reach the number that defines your future and what you're telling me is important to you. It is so valuable to go through that process. The problem is that one, business owners are so focused on growing their business, they rarely get to that side even while they're growing their business. Their business is their retirement. Mm-hmm. But two, you're asking them to do this while they're going through a process to sell their company, which is very intrusive, very time consuming, very emotional. And so as you go through this process over here, if you don't have those two teams connected, kind of stewarding you through that process, you know, you may not get through it. And the result could be, you know, pretty devastating if all of a sudden you're sitting there thinking, what do I do now? Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Okay, rapid fire here. You got 10 seconds to answer each of these questions. What's the first thing that you look at in a seller's financials?
EBITDA.
What kind of deal falls apart after an LOI?
One that's not prepared for due diligence.
Okay. And what percentage is that?
I'd say maybe 40. That's off the top of my head. A lot of deals don't survive due diligence.
Should you sell during a boom or wait for the perfect buyer?
I definitely would say sell during a boom.
Yeah, waiting, when there's money out there.
Yeah, waiting and timing for the perfect buyer can really work against you.
Most common mistake during due diligence?
Thinking that you can do it without professional advisory services.
Yeah. Okay, auction process or one-on-one negotiation?
That's a tough one. I could go either. You might have a one-on-one negotiation with somebody who doesn't want you to go to the auction process, and so again, if they can give you the number that's reverse engineered to your lifestyle that you're trying to accomplish.
Sometimes it's like most likely to close the deal too, right? Because deals fall apart. Yeah. Okay. Best case, worst case on how long does it take to get a deal done once you've got the LOI?
Yeah, I'd say this is a tough one. I'd say worst case is like tomorrow, right? Worst case is so soon you have no time to plan anything.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay. I thought you were going to say like a year and a half.
No. I think best case is a year to 2 years.
Yeah.
If you were to talk to a tax attorney, they would say 2 years to 3 years, right?
Yeah. Because, but once you get the LOI, how long does it typically take to close? 90 days, 120 days?
Yeah, it's all over the place, but I'd say within like 3 to 6 months. Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Weirdest thing you've ever seen kill a deal?
Gosh, that's a tough one. I once saw a deal not move forward because the owners thought very poorly of private equity. They signed like 70 something NDAs, met with all of them, and literally
they just didn't like any of them.
They just had so much pride in what they were doing and were so confident that they just said, hey, this you know, forget these guys. Like, we don't need to do this.
Okay, what's the most undervalued industry today?
Undervalued. I don't know. I don't know how I would answer that one. That is a tough one. Yeah. I mean, AI is, you know, AI is like running around with its hair on fire. I mean, it's everywhere and it's bleeding into everything. So, yeah, but that would be a tough one to answer.
Okay. So, I was going to say, do sellers get fatigued during the selling process and why?
Yeah. Yeah. Of course they do. Because it's, you know, you're going through normal operating procedures in your company, and now you're really taking on a different role of, hey, let's prepare this for a sale. And it's just not stuff that you do every day. And so a lot of times you don't know how to do it. And if you don't know how to do it, you need to hire out for it. And that means you need to trust somebody, and that can be tough to do. And even if you find somebody to trust, you know, there's probably six or eight of those partners that you're going to have to bring in on that process. And that's a lot of trust to lay over on other people's shoulders.
Okay. So last thing, you got a big event coming up, mm-hmm. and I think it's coming up, you said on the 16th, was it?
Yeah. October 16th.
All right. Tell us about, it's called the Boss Event.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How'd you come up with the name, and what could we expect if we go, and who's it for, and who's it really not for?
Yeah. No, thanks for asking. So Boss Events were created by Raymond James as they've gone through this process to really tie the investment banking services with the wealth management services. And so it stands for Business Owner Strategy Summit. It's on October 16th. This is really an opportunity for business owners who are either in two camps. One is, hey, I'm looking for some access to growth capital, and I'm just really not sure how to do that. Maybe I've grown to a point where I know I could expand, but I just don't have the capital. I need some help there. And so we'll have some bankers there that can kind of talk to that. Most of the content is going to be around preparing for an exit. So we'll have, I think I can mention these names, but Weintraub Tobin is going to be there, right? M&A Advisory Services. Yep. Cohen Resnick. So we have some guys flying in from Cohen Resnick, so accounting firm. Mm-hmm. John Garolka with Garolka Law is going to be there to really address the personal like tax planning and estate planning. We have Meridian Capital out of Seattle, which is a boutique investment banking firm that we work very closely with. Raymond James Investment Bank will be there. And the whole tone of the event is to educate these business owners on how they should prepare, how they should start to lay the foundation for a process to sell their business within, say, the next 3 to 5 years. It's educational. There is no sales pitch. There is no ask. It is really just built to kind of pull the curtain back and say, hey, these are some war stories. This is what went wrong. These are some things that you should be thinking about. Let's talk about entity. Let's talk about QSBS and 1202 stock, mm-hmm. and how that can be a wonderful thing for you. And really just kind of educate. What we hope comes out of it is the business owners leave and reach out to one or two or more of the team and just say, hey, I really enjoyed what you spoke about. I'd like to learn more. Mm-hmm. Or I'm actually getting ready to go through this process very soon and I'm feeling overwhelmed. Can you guys help me understand this? We do one in Sacramento in the fall. We do one in San Francisco in the spring. And so I have an office in San Francisco in the Salesforce Tower. So we have one coming up there in May, which will be probably a lot more focused on tech, right? The local Sacramento event is, like you have some agricultural companies, you definitely have some professional services in there. You have like a few, like tech companies that are going to be there, but, that's the whole plan is just sitting there and educating people. We'll have a panel, which thank you for joining our panel on, buyers and sellers. So, hey, I sold my company and, you know, the moderator might ask something like, you know, what would you have done differently? Or how did you prepare for taxes? Or, you know, what was your experience with private equity? And then we'll have, you know, buyers. So guys that are actually out there actively looking to purchase companies. And so we might pose some questions like, what are you looking for? What's a red flag to you? It's really to just share information with these business owners who, you know, are probably going to sell their company at some point. And they're probably not very familiar with what they're getting into. And so we just want to prepare them as best as possible for it.
That's great. Well, I look forward to that. I will be there. It's I think it starts at like 2:00 or something like that.
Yeah, starts at 2:00. I would say if you're interested in attending, I would send me an email. It is okay. Invite only. So it is for businesses that have reached a certain level of success and have some complexity. But let's have a conversation about it. So if you're interested, you can email me at bradley.frisk@raymondjames.com, or you can call me at 916-501-1659. We'll talk about what your goals are and we'll extend an invite, but there is okay, some cool, pretty limited seating.
So. And if you hit me up and I can connect you to Brad as well, if somebody out there is just kind of connected to me already, I'd be glad to make an intro. So, okay, very cool. Thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for all the wisdom.
Yeah.
You know, it's just stuff that you don't talk about with your neighbors, right? Who do you talk about it with? You need to talk to some other business people who have kind of been through it is the best way to do it versus kind of guessing or living in the dark. So, yeah. Thanks. It's good to get the word out there.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a really unique community. I'm proud to be part of it. I love your involvement in it. And again, you know, we just want to see business owners have a positive outcome, not only in you know, selling their financial asset, but also in, you know, life after the sale and what that means for them.
100%. Thanks a lot, Brad.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You bet. And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at the Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.